Awesome. man, it's great to be with you guys. We're going to have a great week as we continue to work on our skills for exposition. I've got the context talk here. We're going to spend some time dealing with context in the scriptures. Just to orient ourselves in terms of where this is in our preparation, just as Jeremy was talking about earlier, we've got a text, and we are always thinking about what can I bring to the people that I'm either teaching or preaching to? How can I bring a message that's relevant to our people? And just as he mentioned earlier, we are tempted to just grab something from a text and then, without regard to what the author's saying, bring it to bear on our people. And that's what we're trying to avoid. As one brother said earlier, we're trying to get the Bible to speak for itself. And that is how that involves exegesis. That involves exegesis. Getting our author's main point, then continuing along theological reflection before we begin the work of persuasion. And so, as Jeremy spoke about earlier, everything that we're going to be dealing with in this session is in the leg of exegesis. He started with structure. And now we're moving on to context. All through the process of exegesis, all with the aim of getting what Luke is trying to get across. What is this gospel writer trying to convey? That's what we're trying to figure out through our structure work. And that's what we're trying to figure out as we add this other type of tool set to it, which is called context. Now, I don't know if you have one of your worksheets with you, in front of you. I've got a copy of it right here. And the first question set is about structure. How has the author organized this passage? That's a question about structure. You see, I call it a question set. It's not really question one, it's question set one, because it says, show the structure in sections, explain the strategies, what emphasis did you discern? That's a whole set of questions, right? Similarly, when you move on to question set two, the question that you'll see there is, how does context inform the meaning of the passage? And then it says, consider literary context, historical context, cultural context, biblical context. And we're gonna talk about all four of those. But the key is, how does this context inform the meaning of the passage? Now, you could take that in two steps. I'll call step one the simple step, and step two the thoughtful step. Okay? The simple step is identifying the context. One, identify. What's the context? If you're talking about literary context, you would point to the passage before your text. You would point to the passage after your text. That's identifying the literary context. Or if you're talking about biblical context, you might have a citation or an allusion in your passage, and you're like, you know what? This is quoting Isaiah chapter 40. Okay, you've identified. Great. You've identified the context. But the question in your worksheet is, how does the context inform the meaning of the passage? Well, that brings you to the thoughtful step. Of thinking through, okay, now that I've identified this context, how does it help me understand my passage? And we've all done it, and you're going to see it in your small groups, where you identify context, but you actually don't make the second thoughtful step of saying, and here's how it helps me understand. So I just want to help us make a little progress in identifying not just how where the context is, but how it actually works in helping us understand. Let me give you an example of context or misappropriation of a text and how context might help. I've got three sons. I've got an older son, a middle son, and a youngest son. The oldest son is 21. My middle son is 16. My youngest son is 8. My oldest son is 21, and he's in college, and he doesn't have any household chores because he has a job, and he's a full-time student, and we've just said, okay, right, school and work, those are your chores. Middle son, he's got a lot of chores, including mowing the lawn. And I leave him a note. And I tape it to the kitchen table. My youngest son goes and reads that note. Okay? And bringing the words of dad, he comes to my oldest son, who has no chores, and says, "Thus saith dad, you are going to have to get back to mowing as your chore because it has to get done." Now, I don't know exactly how my oldest son is going to take this, but it sounds very authoritative. And he did say, my youngest son said, "I read this from dad's word, and I'm delivering it to you." But here's the actual note. "Dear middle son, because you're working hard and investing your time in football this fall, I'm going to take over mowing the yard. I did include this sentence. You are going to have to get back to mowing as your chore because it has to get done. But I'll do it until after the football season. Love, dad." Okay. My youngest son has just ripped that sentence out of context, delivered it to a different audience, and absolutely mangled the meaning that I was conveying, right? I mean, we got two different types of context going on here. We got historical context because he's changed the audience, and then we've got literary context because he's taken everything around it and just ignored it. That's how we might go about mishandling something if we ignore context. Now, we might do it with noble intentions. It may be that my youngest son just wanted to see dad's work get done. I can tell dad that you want to get the lawn mowed, and so I'm trying to help. I'm using your word to get your work done. Right? But you have mishandled my word, and I already had a plan for getting my work done. Thank you very much. Here's the picture that we use to just remind us about context. Your text is in contexts. It's in contexts. Whatever text you're working from has texts on either side of it. Your text, whatever text you're working with, has an audience it's been written to. That's a part of its context. Your text might include references to other scriptures. It's part of its context. Your text might include things that are kind of unique to its time, the time of the story that it's in place there. That's a part of its context. Understanding the elements and the details of that take place inside that text, it's part of its context. In fact, we are not going to understand our passage unless we understand the context. Here's the principle. We must understand how context informs the meaning of our passage. We must understand how context informs the meaning of our passage. We've got a text. We're working to understand it. We need to understand the contexts in which it's situated if we're going to really get a handle on it. Now, you notice I put several circles around it. I talked about different types of context. There are different kinds of contexts that we're asking for, as I pointed out on the worksheet, asking for you to consider at least when you're talking about your, understanding your text. And the four that are listed there, let's go through them. One is, and I'm going to do this in sort of, we're going to handle the first two because they are less helpful in Luke, cultural. Cultural context. This is things that are inside your text that may need some explanation for your audience. Like the parable of the 10 minas. What's a mina? What in the world is that? If you don't understand then what that is and you can't explain it, then you're going to miss an understanding of the text. But it's a detail inside your text that may need explanation. It doesn't even come up that often, especially in the Gospels. But when it does, you need to figure that out. How would you go about figuring out what a cultural detail is in a text? What would you do? Reference work like? Okay. Encyclopedia. Bible dictionary. Even just the ESV study Bible, right? It's going to have some notes in there, or even sometimes just footnotes in a pew Bible. Are you going to have the kind of explanations you need? That will usually get it done to understand the cultural pieces that need to be explained. There's also historical context. I want to help us understand the distinction between these two. Cultural context involves details in the text that may need explanation. Characters, terms. Historical context is about the audience to whom the text is written. Who received originally these writings from this author? What's their situation like? So the author of your biblical text is delivering these writings to a particular audience, and understanding that person or person's situation is going to make a difference in how you interpret. Like just like my little example with my sons, like who receives this note has a big impact on its meaning, right? Who receives the Gospel of Luke? Theophilus, right? Okay, so we got Theophilus. Aside from that, and understanding that it's being delivered to a Christian who has basically commissioned this account, it's not otherwise very helpful for us in the Gospel of Luke, this cultural or historical context. And so, on your worksheet, as you do your small groups, it's going to say, include only what is relevant to the meaning of the passage. That's going to be really important for your discussions. You don't have to drive through like, hey, I dug up all this stuff. You've got four different types of context. I guess I got to just plow all through them all. That's actually just what's relevant to help us understand how it informs the passage. So historical context, that's the audience, original audience, and their situation. Third kind of context I want to talk about is biblical. Biblical context. Biblical context are citations and allusions that are inside your passage that your author is picking up and putting down in his text, right? So the gospel writer Luke picking up a citation for Isaiah or picking up an allusion to another biblical passage and putting it down in your passage in order to make a point. When you see a citation or allusion in your passage, I like to think of it as like a hyperlink, right? So You want to double click on that citation or allusion and go back to the whole website and read the whole website to understand what that prior author is doing so that you can understand how Luke is using it. Let's look at an example. Citations. Let me just write that. Citations and allusions. Let's consider Luke 3:1-9. I'm going to turn there. As you look at Luke 3, one through nine, you can see just by glancing at the page that he's got a citation there. This is, just by looking at the footnotes, this is from Isaiah. You can see that it's from Isaiah chapter 40. Here's what I'd like you to do. With your neighbor, read Luke 3:1-9. Sorry, 40. Read Luke 3:1-9, and then double click on that citation and go back to Isaiah 40 and read verses 1-11 with your neighbor. And here's what I want you to keep in mind as you read. How does Luke use Isaiah to point to Christ's identity? How does Luke use Isaiah? How does he appropriate Isaiah to point to Christ's identity? Go ahead and read those texts now with your neighbor. You've discussed this with your neighbor. So what are you seeing about how Luke is using Isaiah to point to the identity of Christ? Yeah, Jeremy's comment about get your theology out of the way. Let's just take Luke for what he's saying. Anybody else? How is Luke using Isaiah to point to the identity of Christ in this case? The one who's greater, who is that in Isaiah? Yahweh, right? Prepare the way for Yahweh. In fact, in Isaiah chapter 40, this is where Isaiah is now looking forward to a day where Yahweh returns to the land. Not only the exiles return, but Yahweh returns to the land. And now, here comes Luke, and he just picks up this piece from Isaiah, which in doing so, he's not just referring to some words, he's referring to an entire thing that Isaiah is doing, and he's putting it here and saying, here we go. Yahweh is returning to his people. Amen. Right? That's powerful, but it's only available to us if we go back to Isaiah and understand, at least in part, at least you know, with some understanding, what Isaiah chapter 40 is doing. Take another look at those two passages together and answer this question with your neighbor. What is Luke doing with this passage to suggest the scope of Christ's work? Take a look again. How is Luke appropriating Isaiah to suggest the scope of Christ's work? What you notice about the scope of Christ's work? Yeah, the glory of the Lord. All flesh is going to see the glory of the Lord. How does Luke appropriate that? The salvation of the Lord, right? That's right. Now, Luke is not doing something different than Isaiah is doing. He's not misappropriating Isaiah. If you read Isaiah 40 and 41, you see that from the beginning, Isaiah saw that the scope of the work of God included the Gentiles. But instead of quoting 40 through 41, right? He takes the scope of the Gentile salvation and he scooches it in to this citation, and he just alters the word a little bit. And he's altering the word not to change it, but to express it. All flesh will see the salvation of Yahweh. So this is kind of how biblical context works in our gospel texts. You're going to see citations or allusions to prior biblical writing, right? This is prior biblical writing. And double-click on that thing. Go to that full place. Read the whole website and understand as best you can what that Old Testament usually author is doing. Yeah, always in Luke. What that author is doing so that you can understand what Luke is doing with him. Okay, biblical context. Let's look at literary context. That's our fourth kind. If you see on your worksheet, you got cultural, you got historical, biblical. Our fourth type of context that's on our worksheet is literary context. Literary context just means what's around my passage. And oftentimes, if you just read what's just prior and just after your passage, it's going to reveal a lot about what the passage you're dealing with means. Now, you can go wider and wider, and you're going to want to study your book so that you understand the context of the whole book. But often when you're dealing with these texts, just what's right before, what's right after is going to be of greatest help. Let's look at an example like Mark 8. This is right where we were, where Jeremy left off. Mark 8, 22 through 26. And let's take this in two steps. One, the simple step. Identify the context. Here, I'm going to identify as relevant context. I'm just going to do this part for you, right? Just for the sake of time. 8, 14 through 21, and 8, 27 through 9, 1, right? These are the passages just before and just after. But the thoughtful step is how does that context inform the meaning? So, with your neighbor, what I want you to do is just read this passage here, Mark 8, 22 through 26, without the context. Without the context. And just ask yourself, what do I think Mark is communicating with this thing? Without any context, what do I think Mark is communicating to his readers with this odd miracle? Just read it alone. Go for it. What's that? Okay. So what is weird about this? What's surprising about what happens here? What's that? Miracle takes two tries. Jesus is like, oh, this usually works. That is odd. What's going on? Let's start with our prior context. You've already got a little bit of a head start on this. If you look at Mark 8, 14 through 21, I want you to just ask, what is the basic issue prior to this passage? What's the basic issue? And we've already got a head start because Jeremy was in that passage. Take a look at it. Spiritual blindness. They don't understand Christ. They don't understand. And Luke, of course, is doing the whole look to the lens. Do you understand? Which is awesome. They saw what Jesus did with the bread. Yeah. But they don't understand. They don't perceive. And then you come to this blind guy, and as Jesus looks to heal him, He sees part of the way, and then he sees the whole way. Okay, that's interesting. What's at issue is the perception of the disciples. Then you get this odd miracle. Let's look at the following context. And as you look at the following context, this is going to be 8:27 through 9:1. Let's ask ourselves this question. What is similar? What is similar between the following context and our miracle? Go ahead, read with your neighbor. Ask yourselves that question. So you read and you discussed with your neighbor. What do you see that Luke has placed this miracle and this account next to each other? What do you see that is similar in the following context? Peter sees, but he doesn't see. What does he see? What? Yeah. You are the Christ. How does he says it's really stark. You are the Christ. But he doesn't see. What doesn't he see? Yeah. And when Christ says I suffer and die, then Peter makes it very clear that he does not yet perceive who Christ is and what he does. And as you read that, he also doesn't see the implications for his followers, right? He doesn't see the implication for his followers. So this weird miracle that takes Jesus a couple of swings, how are we even going to understand that? I mean, we might look at it, and we might ask kind of the questions that Jeremy was asking us earlier about, well, what's surprising? How does this work? What are the pieces? But until we dive into the literary context, we see what's at play regarding the disciples' perception, and then how that perception is layered, how they need a couple of swings, actually need a couple of swings to understand not only who Christ is, but what his work is about and the implications for his followers. Are we going to understand our text? So that leads us to that second thoughtful step. If we look at that text, not only have we identified the context, but now we do the thoughtful work of understanding, okay, how does it inform the meaning of my passage? Does anybody want to articulate it? Take a try. Jesus alone grants full spiritual sight about who he is and what he does. Yeah, I think that's a pretty good way of putting it, right? And without the context, that remains a little bit opaque to us in that miracle text. Let's do another one. Let's consider Luke 19, verses 11 through 27. Also, as a part of the structure, we've noticed this purpose preamble that they supposed the kingdom of God was appear immediately, and then he said this. So we're working with an emphasis like this. Okay, I'm just going to give you an emphasis so that, you know, for the sake of our exercise. This is about how different responses to the king get handled on his return. Okay, something like that is what we're picking up. Now, I want you to just read this passage and consider, who is this king and the constituency that doesn't want him? Who is he? And who doesn't want? You got suspicions? Who's this king? Who doesn't want him? You're just guessing at this. They're informed guesses, right? Who's the king? Always a good answer when it comes to kings. But, I mean, does it say that? Okay. Who doesn't want him? Who's he talking about? Suspicions, right? This is, what did you say, the bomb area? Okay, the Jews, the authorities. These are suspicions, right? Okay, well, let's consider the following context. Let's go ahead and read on 19, 28 through 40 to confirm our suspicions. Do we have this right? Right? Jesus is telling a parable. We want to make sure we get it right. Can our following context help us confirm or refute or shape our suspicions? That's what we're asking when we're doing context work. Go ahead. Read your neighbor. See what it's... How did the following context help confirm, refute, or shape your interpretive suspicions? And let me just... I'm going to actually put that up on the board. Confirm, refute, or shape your interpretive suspicions. This is just a great question to be asking yourself as you use all of these tools. Hey, here's what I'm thinking. What does the tool do to my thinking? Go ahead. Somebody over here. I saw a hand. How did the following context confirm, refute, or shape your interpretive suspicions about who the king is and who doesn't want him? There you go. We thought the king was Jesus. Turns out we were right. Okay. Shut these people up. Okay. So this was something that you were like, okay, I think this is probably what's going on here in this parable, but that's not how you want to handle your sermons, right? I think this is kind of what's going on here. You want to be able to do the context work necessary to confirm at least your suspicions. They might shape them. Okay. Now I want to do another thing with this particular parable before we're done. You see this key statement? About this king. You are a severe man. You take what you did not deposit, and you reap what you do not sow. Right? I say key because, okay, he's got that in 21. And then it's repeated. The king doesn't say, no, you got me wrong. He repeats exactly what this servant says. You're a severe man. You take what you did not deposit. You reap where you do not sow. And the king says, oh, you knew that about me, huh? That I'm a severe man, that I take what I do not deposit and reap what I did not sow. It's used as a defining characteristic for this king, and that's not usually how we think about Jesus. So how are we going to understand it? Well, how would the other characters in this parable understand it? How would they confirm or refute or shape our understanding of that statement? Well, you've got the enemies, I would say, we feel like being slaughtered in front of him is severe. You've got the good servants. They went from, you know, being given, you know, 15 grand to being in charge, being governor of a state, right? Well, that's kind of severe. But who in the context would have something to say about the seriousness or severity or the reaping and the collecting of Jesus? Well, let's look a chapter back. We've got the near context of 18 through 26, the rich ruler, and 26 through 30, Zacchaeus. With that in mind, that through 30, that's the followers. And then you have 19, 1 through 10, Zacchaeus. I want to take this key statement, you are a severe man. You can just kind of underline that in your Bible or keep your finger on that particular characterization of the king and look at the prior context, the rich ruler, the following disciples, and Zacchaeus. How would they confirm or deny or shape that statement? That's my question. How would they confirm, deny, or shape that statement about the king? Go ahead and read with your neighbor. Brother, right here, down front. What would you say about this prior context? You got the rich ruler, you got the following disciples, you got Zacchaeus. How would each of them either confirm, deny, or shape this statement? You're a severe man. You collect what you didn't deposit. You reap where you did not sow. What do you think? Clear the decks. Severe? Why? Mm-hmm. Like watching a camel go through the eye of a needle. Yeah. So, is that severe? Like, kind of yeah. Kind of nah. And Jesus walks into Zacchaeus' house. Talk about collecting where you did not deposit. Jesus just walks in for lunch, and money goes flying out of that house. Right? And what he says to his followers is this. You know, Peter's like, hey, we gave up everything. There's no one who's given up houses or family that's not going to return back so much more in this life and in the life to come. Just like our 10 mina guy who ends up going from being given, you know, 15 grand to being the governor of 10 cities. Is that severe? So how does that shape our understanding of this key description of the king, that which seems bizarre, right? Is that where we agree on that? Like when we read this, like we know this is Jesus. He's agreeing. He's severe and he reaps where he does not sow and he collects where he does not deposit. This is serious. In what way are we supposed to understand this? When we dive into the context, we get actually some information. It informs our understanding of how, in what way, is Christ a severe man? Obviously, there is more to the passages of the rich young ruler and Zacchaeus than just understanding this parable. Don't get me wrong on that. You've got those as small group texts. There's a lot more to say about those. But as Luke strings these pearls together, they all inform each other. And we have to understand, where's my principle here? We have to understand how context informs the meaning of our passage. Identify the context. Ask yourself, how does this inform?